theodicy is an attempt to justify God in the presence of suffering and evil, and there are a range of them. Personally, I don't find them helpful, but some people do find them helpful. A typical theodicy is what's called the free will defense, which I think goes back to Arrhenius or somebody. I can't remember where it arose. But the free will defense says that God wants to give people free will to choose. And if you're going to let people choose, you have to have both good and evil. Otherwise, there would be nothing. There would be no possibility of choice. So that's why you have to have suffering and evil. Now, the argument against that, which I find convincing, is that that wouldn't account for the degree of evil that's found. You could choose between different degrees of goodness. You wouldn't have to have quite so much suffering and evil. So I'm personally not convinced by that argument, but many people are, and I mention it because it's helpful to some people. And there are the range of other theodicies that we can't see the whole picture, we can't understand the mind of God, and so on. But there's been a strand of Judeo-Christian theology that tries to explain the existence of apparently meaningless suffering. I don't think the problem can be solved. You can either take the position of the process theologians, who say that there are two aspects of God. One is transcendent, and the other is much more immanent. And at the immanent level, God is not in charge of everything that goes on. There are some things that God cannot control. There's a certain aspects of the universe that just obey natural law and are not under the control of God. The problem has been, if God is omnipotent and could prevent evil but doesn't, how could he be all good? If he cannot prevent evil, how could he be omnipotent? That's been the difficulty, a God who's all good and omnipotent. That problem goes back a long way. So the process theologians have dealt with that by saying, well, there's an aspect of God which is not fully omnipotent. That was why Rabbi Kushner wrote that book, When Bad Things Happen to Good People. It's a similar kind of argument, I think, based on process theology that originated with Whitehead. Jung takes a different tack and says that God is not all good, that God has a dark side. That's another suggested solution to this problem. In the Islamic tradition, the approach to suffering is very similar to the Jewish and Christian view. In Buddhism, the problem of suffering is again central. The Buddha begins his discourses by saying that life is suffering or unsatisfactory or something like that, that life is impermanent, subject to decay and change, so our nature is to suffer. So the problem from their point of view is that we're hanging on to a sense of self that we think is permanent, and to possessions and to a world that we assume is permanent, but actually everything is impermanent and interdependently arising, okay? And everything changes, and we shouldn't cling to this sense of self that we have, or to outer objects and so on, that we are, that the self is not a separate essence. So everything that's going on is part of the change and flow of things. Buddhists also subscribe to the law of karma, the notion of cause and effect, and so do the Hindus. That any suffering any suffering you experience in this world is the result of karma that you've accrued from past lives, and so on. There is an inexorable law of cause and effect. So actions bring fruit, either in this life or the next life, in the form of happiness or unhappiness or pleasure or pain. So every time you're reborn, you bring with you the fruits of actions in past lives. I find that personally a helpful notion. It's a notion that used to be part of the Christian tradition, but disappeared a long time ago. So Christians, usually believing Christians, won't accept the idea of karma. They tell me when I discuss this with them, no, you just get one shot and this is it. But the Hindus say, no, you get lots of shots. You keep coming back and you can try again. If you miss the first time, it doesn't matter so much. All right, so what about some psychological approaches? Well, I mentioned the notion of the transformation of God. Another important idea is the issue of finding meaning in suffering. What does this mean? You know, many people have a kind of unconscious notion of what I would call a moral universe. Without thinking about it, we often tend to assume that the world is a reasonable place, that people are largely benevolent, that we get what we deserve and we deserve what we get. We have these kind of unconscious ideas in our mind. And then when suffering occurs, this kind of belief is called into question. Does this have any meaning? Is life really purposeful? So this is when a life crisis can have important developmental possibilities because it can stimulate new meaning. Can I see connections between my present suffering and what happened to me in childhood or in development? Is there something about my personal character structure which is contributing to this? Do I have to take a direction in life that I didn't think I would have to take? Can I understand my suffering in a larger context? Is there really a spiritual background to the universe? Am I really connected to something larger than myself? Can I find meaning in a vocation? The issue of vocation is very important. You know, it was important to Jung. He thought that vocation was given by the self. It doesn't come out of the ego. He says it's like the Tao moving through you when you have a true calling. So you know, you may go into a useful career, but it may not be your true vocation. We see that a lot at Pacifica, where people have been lawyers and doctors and teachers and so on. And then at some point, usually in midlife, they realize that, you know, they've climbed to the top of the ladder, but the ladder's been leaning up against the wrong wall. That kind of situation. So they had a useful career, but it was not their true.